From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, promising new treatments for cancer. We'll talk with Dr. John Mendelsohn, a leading researcher and inventor of the new drug C225. He says understanding the cause of cancer has led to an explosion of new drugs that are more effective with fewer side effects. Also, a short movie that reenacts a Revolutionary War battle in the streets of modern-day Brooklyn. Filmmaker Joseph McCarthy rented a fleet of red cars to represent the British troops. And music critic Milo Miles reviews a tribute album to Mississippi John Hurt. It's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Macedonia's rival parties reached a tentative peace deal today. The agreement came hours after the government reported 10 soldiers killed in a rebel ambush. The insurgents took up arms in February, saying they were fighting for greater rights for minority ethnic Albanians. Albanians account for about a third of Macedonia's 2 million people. The Western-designed peace plan grants Albanians a greater role in police, parliament, and education. Some 3,500 NATO soldiers would disarm the rebels, but only after the rival sides fully agree on a deal. In Washington, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said he's aware of reports of a tentative deal, but said it was too soon to celebrate. In Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin, a party linked to the Irish Republican Army, has given its response to the Anglo-Irish peace package. Party President Gerry Adams has predicted the collapse of all government institutions set up under the 1998 peace accord. Marianne McGuire reports.
Gerry Adams has given a bleak assessment of the prospects of compromise and has predicted the collapse of the power-sharing government.
The reality is that the institutions are going to collapse in a very short time.
His comments come as the peace accord has hit its worst crisis in 3 years. Adams blamed the collapse of the institutions on the pro-British unionist leader David Trimble. Yesterday, Trimble dismissed plans by the IRA to render weapons unusable, calling them inadequate. He has now given the armed group a new ultimatum, telling them to start disarming by Thursday. If no compromise is found by Sunday, Britain will be forced to suspend the power-sharing government. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
Much of the nation continues to swelter in the August heat wave. Some cities, like Philadelphia, are dealing with another day of unhealthy air. From member station WHYY, Stacia DeMarco reports.
Philadelphia has declared this an ozone action day because ground-level ozone is exceeding the federal air quality standard. Stephen Luxenberg is the air quality planner at the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission. He advises people to limit their ozone intake during this heat spell.
Ozone basically does to the inside of your lungs what the sun does to the outside of your lungs. It causes basically some kind of a burn. And in children and asthmatics, that burn can be pretty bad.
Luxenberg asks that people refuel their vehicles in the evening to reduce ozone-causing chemicals that bake in the sun. For NPR News, I'm Stacia DeMarco in Philadelphia.
Maureen Reagan is dead. She was the oldest child of former President Ronald Reagan and his first wife, actress Jane Wyman. Maureen Reagan lost a 5-year fight with cancer. She was 60 years old. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 165 points to close at 10,293. The Nasdaq was down 61, and the S&P 500 fell 21 points. This is NPR News. President Bush helped put the walls of a new house up today as part of a Habitat for Humanity event in Waco, Texas. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The president is less than a week into his month-long vacation at his ranch. Today's event was the first of a series of appearances that will get him out of Crawford, Texas, for a day or two at a time between now and Labor Day. The Habitat for Humanity construction site gave the president the chance to praise volunteerism across America. Habitat for Humanity is a 25-year-old Christian nonprofit organization that helps low-income people build and move into their own homes. The Waco construction event was part of a larger Habitat project this month, featuring more than 20 world leaders who are participating in building projects around the world. Former President Jimmy Carter is in South Korea this week as part of that program. Meanwhile, Mr. Bush is back at the ranch in Crawford for the evening. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The United States expressed concern to Italy about 3 U.S. citizens injured by police during mass protests at the Group of Eight summit last month. The comment came as Italy's top police official told a parliamentary inquiry that police had used excessive force during the summit in Genoa. During the actual protest, one protester was shot dead during a confrontation with police. The American scholar released from a Russian prison is back on U.S. soil. Fulbright scholar John Tobin is thanking several people for their support, including President Bush and Secretary of State Colin Powell. He met reporters shortly after his arrival at JFK Airport in New York. He said the most frightening moments were during the uncertainty of what charges he would face. Tobin served half of a one-year term for a drug charge. He was at one time accused of spying. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo and its employees, working together in the Sodexo Stop Hunger program, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. Cancer may be the single most dreaded word in the English language. We all know that medicine has made huge strides and that the diagnosis is not necessarily a death sentence, but cancer is still the second leading cause of death in this country, and the most effective treatments, radiation, surgery, and chemotherapy, can be painful and debilitating. Now, though, a new generation of cancer drugs is beginning to become available. Smart drugs that target cancer on a microscopic level with many fewer side effects. 20 years ago, Dr. John Mendelsohn helped create and develop one of the most promising of these new cancer drugs. It's called C-225, and it's in phase 3 of its clinical trials. It's been shown to be effective with few and relatively minor side effects. Dr. Mendelsohn is now president of the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. He's also a professor of medicine there, and he serves on the board of InClone Systems, the company that's developing C-225. When Dr. Mendelsohn started his research 20 years ago, there was just a handful of promising anti-cancer drugs in development. Today, more than 400 are in the pipeline. I asked him, what's changed?
Well, a lot has changed, and it boils down to the fact that we understand the cause of cancer. Cancer is caused by mutations or malfunctions in certain genes that regulate the growth of cells. And if these are functioning improperly, the cells either die or they grow at an incredibly advantaged way compared to the other cells and become cancer.
What about this process do we understand better?
Well, we've got a catalog now. The Genome Project has identified around 30,000 genes. And that's a great telephone book now with 30,000 addresses in it. So we know where each of these genes is located. But we don't know what goes on at most of those addresses. We've got a lot of work to do still. But we do know that about 400 of those genes are very important for controlling cell growth and cell proliferation. And if one or two of those genes that control cell growth out of that list of 400 is functioning improperly, the cell's in trouble. That might be if you're driving your car and the foot brake doesn't work and the steering is very difficult. You can still use your handbrake and you can still stop and save yourself. But if three or four of those genes that are critical are not working in your car, your accelerator is stuck down, your steering wheel stops working and your brakes don't work, you're either going to crash or you're going to win the race if the road's straight. And that's really what happens in cancer. If three or four of those genes that control proliferation are abnormally functioning, the cell either dies, which is what we'd hope, or it goes on to become malignant. And now that we've identified these genes, we have targets. Chemotherapy in the past was using toxins and poisons that we were trying to tame and make useful for the treatment of cancer.
The treatment was almost as bad as the disease.
Well, I wouldn't go that far because it did cure the disease sometimes. But the first anti-cancer agent came from mustard gas in World War I when the poor soldiers were dying because the mustard gas got in their lungs. The doctors noticed that their white blood cell counts went down before they died. And after the war, they tried to harness mustard gas, and they created a drug called nitrogen mustard, which they could give in the vein in a controlled way. And they used this to treat disorders of white blood cells, and it was effective.
Leukemia?
Leukemia and lymphoma, especially lymphoma and Hodgkin's disease, actually.
Now, when these cells stop working properly, is that because we've inherited bad genes from our parents?
Well, it's a very important question, because now that we know that genes are the target, it doesn't mean that this is all a hereditary problem. Genes can be abnormal for two reasons. We might inherit defects in those genes, or we might acquire the defects in the genes from the environment. And we believe that in the majority of cases, the abnormal genes come from the environment. And we feel that about a third of all the abnormalities that are created that cause cancer come from the carcinogens in tobacco smoke.
A third?
So it's a third. If we all quit smoking, one-third of all cancers would go away. No more gene research, no more pharmaceuticals, just go away. It's the most important thing I can say on this program. If everyone quit smoking, one-third of all cancers would disappear.
Now, is this, you're now able to understand how this operates at the molecular level. So as opposed to the broad stroke, the broad brush approach of chemotherapy or radiation treatment, is this now the equivalent of a smart weapon that zones in on precisely the right target?
That's right. The drug companies, the big drug companies, the biotech companies, and all the academic institutions in the country are zeroing in and collaborating, I think, fairly effectively to design targeted therapies that will fix the problems that these 300 or 400 abnormal genes can create. And we might replace the gene. The gene product is called a protein. We might disarm that protein, or we might put in a protein that is more effective than the one that's abnormal. There's a lot of different approaches to attack the problem that any particular gene abnormality creates.
In the past, cancer researchers have been incredibly reluctant to use words like optimism, breakthrough, certainly cure, because of the enormous weight that so many people put on this. There are so many people who've so desperate for any kind of a cure, and we've all heard stories of people going to Mexico to get Laetril and all these other things. Yet now people are speaking in real optimistic phrases. Is this justified in your view?
It's justified, but it has to be cautious. This is not a case of one big home run, one great discovery that will eliminate all cancers. As I explained, there are probably 400 different targets that we're going to have to develop anti-cancer agents that will affect. And it's usually a combination of four or five of these targets that are abnormal that result in cancer. Now, there's been one wonderful breakthrough that I'm sure you'll bring up, so I'll bring it up, and that's Gleevec. It's a drug that treats chronic myelocytic leukemia. That's a disease of the white blood cells in the bone marrow that get out in the blood. Now, in that particular form of cancer, we believe that one gene abnormality is the cause of the cancer, rather than the usual four or five that I mentioned, and mm-hmm. It could be six or seven. And so when a drug was developed that could disarm the product of that particular gene that causes chronic myelocytic leukemia, we had just striking results in patients.
You said an interesting thing, particular kinds of cancer. It's important to understand that this is not one disease, but a lot of different diseases.
Right. I think the way we've thought about cancer in the past is it's in the breast, or it's in the lung, or it's in the brain, and the tissue where the cancer occurred was the target. Now we're thinking that cancer can occur in any of those areas, but it might be some of the same genes causing the cancer, whether it appeared in the brain or in the colon or in the lung. The most common gene abnormality we've discovered so far, and we as the collective scientific community,
sure,
is P53, which was the molecule of the year in Science magazine a few years ago. And P53 is abnormal in the majority of all cancers. So we're treating P53 problem rather than colon cancer or lung cancer. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And as you look at, for example, if I were a patient, you would look at my disease on the molecular level rather than saying there's a spot on your lung, you've got lung cancer.
That's right. Stanley Hamilton is our new head of pathology, and we recruited him here to set up a program where we're going to do gene screening on all cancers from all patients. So when the PATH specimen comes from Mrs. Smith's breast cancer and is sent to the pathology department, In the past, we'd look in a microscope and we'd stain the specimen with some dyes that were invented in Germany in the late 1800s, and we'd say this is breast cancer or it's not breast cancer and it looks more aggressive or less aggressive. But in the future, a piece of that tumor will be sent to the molecular pathology lab rather than the microscope lab, and we're going to get a list of the 5 or 6 genes that are abnormally expressed in that particular patient's cancer.
So if you're not devising, one single magic bullet that will eliminate this entire range of diseases, are you convinced that now you guys are on the right track, that this is the right approach, and that this is just the beginning?
I believe that very strongly, and I think the best analogy is infectious disease. If you go back 100 years to the year 1901, Pasteur and Koch and a lot of really wonderful scientists had determined that bacteria caused some of the major diseases in our lives. The most common cause of death in 1901 was pneumonia, and the second most common cause of death was tuberculosis. And at that time, we had identified the cause. Now, it wasn't a list out of 400. It was a list in pneumonia. There were half a dozen bugs that caused most pneumonias. And tuberculosis, it's one kind of tuberculosis germ, although it can deviate and get resistant. And once that had been discovered, science got busy and said, let's make targeted chemotherapy against those germs. Now, that chemotherapy is called antibiotics. And today, if you get pneumonia, you go to the doctor and you cough into a plate, and the next day the report comes back and tells the doctor which germ caused your pneumonia. And in most cases, in the cases of viruses, we don't have good treatment yet, but in most cases, which are bacterial, the report tells you which antibiotic will work against that germ. And you treat it, and pneumonia is no longer the first cause of death. It's down the list, and tuberculosis is off the top 10 because we have specific treatments. We'll never get rid of those diseases, but we've reduced their burden on public health. And the same thing, I think, will be happening in cancer. It's more complicated. The list is 400, we believe, and we could be off a bit. And any one cancer has a number of genes that are malfunctioning, so we're going to need a cocktail of targeted treatments to treat the cancer.
My guest is cancer researcher Dr. John Mendelsohn. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Dr. John Mendelsohn, president of the University of Texas MD Anderson Center in Houston. And Dr. Mendelsohn, this is a story of these new cancer drugs that you, amongst many others, are developing that seems to involve, bold and innovative research, but bold and innovative entrepreneurs as well. Tell us the story of C-225.
Well, back in 1980, I was on the faculty at the University of California, San Diego, working with a colleague named Dr. Gordon Sato. And at that time, we were studying the epidermal growth factor receptor. Now, just briefly, there's on the surface of cells, there are receptors that are like locks. And around the cells, there are stimulators of those receptors. Those are called growth factors that are like keys. Mm-hmm. And the analogy I make is if you get into a car, you got to put a key into the lock and turn the ignition, and that sends a signal, an electric signal that starts the motor and puts on your power brakes and your power steering and the lights and everything goes. But if you don't put that key in that lock, nothing happens. The same thing controls the growth and proliferation of cells. There's locks on the surface of the cell and there's keys. The locks are called receptors and the keys are called growth factors. What we knew in 1980 was that there was, from the work of Dr. Stanley Cohen, who won the Nobel Prize for this, we knew that there was a very important lock called the epidermal growth factor receptor, and there was a key called epidermal growth factor. So we had also learned from the scientific literature that there were cancer cells that expressed very high levels of this receptor, And
now, when you say that, you mean that this chemical shows up in excess amounts when you've got a certain kind of cancer.
Right. It turns out many kinds of cancer. The data subsequently have shown that of about one-third of all cancers, there's huge numbers of these locks on the surface of the cell. And Dr. George Todaro and Dr. Michael Sporn published a paper in 1980 summarizing exciting data showing that cancer cells produce their own keys. So the cancer cell produces the key, epidermal growth factor. It excretes this key outside the cell. The key latches onto the lock and turns the ignition, and the cancer cell auto-stimulates itself to proliferate. Now, normally that key doesn't come from the cell. It comes from the environment. If you get a cut on your hand, the epidermal growth factor is carried in the bloodstream, and it stimulates the cells to proliferate, and your wound heals. And as everything heals up, the epidermal growth factor goes away, and the cells stop dividing. But in the cancer case, there were models that we had developed. We and many others had done this, and Dr. Todaro led this, had shown that cancer cells make their own keys and auto-stimulate themselves. So we decided we'd try to block this process by essentially creating a piece of chewing gum that would stick into the lock so the key couldn't get in. And we created an antibody to do this. It was called 225. It was a 225th antibody we studied out of thousands. And this antibody binds to the epidermal growth factor, the receptor, the way antibodies bind to all kinds of molecules. But we selected one that would bind to the very site where the key goes in and blocked the function of the key. And that's why there's such a variety of new drugs coming along. I mean, just attacking the epidermal growth factor receptor, there are at least half a dozen approaches now that are all competing and looking in patient trials to see which will turn out to be the most effective.
Now, yours turned out to be a terrific idea, but from your description, this really does fit Thomas Edison's description of 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration.
Well, it was a lot of work to find this antibody, but I think it was a confluence of information coming from many different scientists that led to this idea, and I think it shows that science from many different directions. I mean, nobody would have guessed when epidermal growth factor was discovered. It was discovered because it helped the maturation of teeth in embryos. Okay, that's really pretty far away from cancer.
Yeah.
And Stanley Cohen worked on this. It was a sort of a far out field. Nobody really knew how important it was until 15 years later. And by 20 years later, he won the Nobel Prize for his work.
Now, as we pick up the story of C225, this new company, ImClone Systems, is beginning production of it. What kinds of cancers does it attack, and how successful is it?
Well, ImClone has produced an awful lot of this antibody. We've treated over 500 patients now. And incidentally, answering your question, it turns out that about a third of all cancers express high levels of EGF receptor. Now, we've concentrated on head and neck cancer, where 90% of the cancers or more express high levels of EGF receptor. And we've looked at advanced bowel cancer, that's in the colon and the rectum. And in that case, probably a third to a half of the patients express high levels of EGF receptor. And we've looked at pancreas, where the majority of patients express high EGF receptor levels. But this could be relevant in lung cancer for well over half. It could be relevant in about 20% of breast cancers, in 30 or 40% of ovarian cancers, in advanced prostate cancer, in bladder cancer. So it doesn't matter where the cancer is. What matters is if that cell depends on the EGF receptor as its key ignition to stimulate proliferation.
And how effective is it?
Well, the initial trials have shown safety. And last May it was at the meeting of the American Association for Cancer Research, three clinical trials were reported looking at combining antibody C225 against the EGF receptor with chemotherapy in head and neck cancer and in colon cancer and in pancreas cancer. And in all cases, we were able to show that adding the antibody increased the efficacy. Now, this isn't 100%, And the tumors didn't shrink forever. Some of them are still responding, but some of the tumors escaped. But this was proof of principle, and this is how it works. You're taking advanced cancer when you're doing something with a new drug. This is proof of principle that adding C225 to chemotherapy can obviously improve the effect of chemotherapy alone, because the patient served as his or her own control. They were finding the tumor was growing. The tumor was responsive to the chemo. It had responded. It was now escaping it. And then when we added the C225, again, the tumor was responding.
When this comes out, if it's as promising as you believe it will be, who's going to make the money?
ImClone and its investors will make money.
Among whom, we should say, are you. You're on the board of ImClone Systems, right?
I'm on the board. I joined the board of ImClone in 1996, as I remember. And they have given me some stock options, so I do have it's way less than 1% of the company, but I do have some interest. And I must say that because of this, I am not treating any of the patients. I don't believe that someone who has a potential financial gain from an experimental therapy should be the person that's treating a patient. The patient has to feel that there's no even possible conflict of interest, and their health has to be the primary thing. So that's why I've held back. But the University of California owns the patent, and they will get funds through the license agreement. And I think the money will go to those that have taken the risk and have put up the capital. ImClone has invested well over $100 million, and it probably will be $200 million in this project by the time everything is signed and sealed. And we don't know yet that this is going to be an approved drug. I want to emphasize that. C225 is still an experiment. Obviously, the fact that we're talking about it together is because there have been very exciting data showing that it seems to be working well, but you haven't crossed home plate until you cross home plate. So this is still an experiment, and the people that are investing in this still are taking some risk.
Dr. Mendelsohn, thank you so much, and I think on behalf of everybody listening, good luck.
Well, thank you very much, and you're wishing good luck to thousands of investigators that are exploring these new approaches to cancer diagnosis and treatment.
Dr. John Mendelsohn helped create and develop C225, a cancer drug that's currently in phase 3 clinical trials. He's president of the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, and a professor of medicine there. Coming up in the second half of our show, an actor dodges taxis and buses to reenact the Revolutionary War's Battle of Brooklyn. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Standing on the mountain. Coming up, a tribute to bluesman Mississippi John Hurt. We're listening to him now. Also, filmmaker Joseph McCarthy, who used rental cars, bicycles, and toy soldiers to reenact a Revolutionary War battle in Brooklyn.
Clouds above me, clouds all around for me. Feeling low and weary, Lord, I've got trouble in mind. Feeling low and weary, Lord, I've got a trouble in mind. Everything's against me, every body's so unkind. Harvest time's coming and will catch me unprepared. Harvest time is coming and will catch me unprepared. Haven't made a dollar bed, luck is all I've had. Lord, how can I bear it? Lord, what will the harvest bring? cow can a barrel load? What will the harvest bring?
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. 225 years ago this month, the fledgling forces of rebellion met an army of British professionals in the first pitched battle of the American Revolution. It was very nearly the last. After the Battle of Brooklyn, George Washington was lucky to evacuate his outnumbered and inexperienced army across the East River to Manhattan. The key point on the battlefield in Brooklyn was a stone house at a crossroads. In their first taste of battle, a small group of soldiers from Maryland assaulted that house three times. They couldn't hold it, but their gallant fight gave the rest of Washington's men time to escape. The American army would live to fight another day. The Marylanders were led by General William Alexander, also known as Lord Stirling. That largely forgotten commander and this neglected battle are the subject of an unusual new movie called The Brave Man. Here's an excerpt.
Our morning started right about here, at 4 a.m., dawn, long before this became Greenwood Cemetery. The date was August 27, 1776.
A Tuesday.
Just 6 weeks after the Declaration of Independence had been read in Philadelphia.
A British fleet of more than 400 ships, including 30 ships of war, had gathered in the harbor of Staten Island.
2 days previously, thousands of redcoats had crossed the Narrows to Bay Ridge out there. When he heard, General Washington reinforced the heights in Brooklyn back up that way to 10,000 men. This place was called Martens Pass back then. The track called the Shore Road crossed it parallel to the harbor on its way toward Brooklyn. Originally, it had been an Indian trail. And now, we call it Fourth Avenue.
Actor Graham Malcolm, who stars first as the narrator and gradually evolves into the character of General Alexander, Lord Stirling. The writer, producer, and director of The Brave Man is Joseph McCarthy. He joins us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
When Graham Malcolm points down Fourth Avenue, what we see is Fourth Avenue. And later, as General Alexander, we see him dodging buses and taxis as he moves his men around the battlefield. Why did you decide to set a costume piece about the American Revolution in the streets of modern Brooklyn?
Well, first off, I didn't have enough money for the 32,000 actors we'd need for the British side and 12,000 people we'd need for the American side. And I guess I was interested in the way we see history. I realized as I walked down Fourth Avenue in the midst of working on another film that you could actually see the landscape of the battle even in this highly developed urban environment. I mean, this was the first suburb, and this had been farmlands for New York, and now it has totally evolved into a semi-industrial area. So still, when you look down from the tops of the small hills, you could see the valleys where the streams must have been. And I realized that when you walk around Brooklyn, you can actually see the history still there.
You not only use Brooklyn itself as itself, you use toy soldiers, kids riding on bikes to act as cavalry, a fleet of red rental cars as standing in for the British Army. This is all pretty experimental.
I was trying to move from the present to the past. I was trying to carry my audience with me, and I think I had the privilege, in a certain sense, to substitute representations of equal power. So when the narrator is looking out toward the British lines, which were approximately down at 33rd Street and 4th Avenue, he saw a red line of men, 5,000 men lined up against him. How could I represent that kind of force on the streets today? And I decided that I could rent 16 red cars, line them up across 4th Avenue, which, if you're a Brooklynite, you know is not a trivial undertaking, and have them lie, I guess, looming waiting to attack. And I felt that that would properly represent what we saw. The same with the bicycles. He's still in modern dress. The British were attacking on the right. I felt that a group of kids on with red shirts on, actually you can't see it, but they're wearing Grant's Lobster Shack. General Grant was the general of the British Army. T-shirts, and they come swooping around to the right, and that was a sense of what was happening. So we're trying to move between the present and the past.
I'm intrigued that in such a short film, it's only 33 minutes long, you do manage to bring out the character of your star, General William Alexander.
Well, thank you. I was trying to, and I guess I have to credit Graham Malcolm a great deal for helping to make that work. He really took the words and made them his own. You see a man being revealed slowly. He starts out arm's length and distant, and you realize that he was a very substantial individual in the colonies. He had, at one time, could probably have been described as the richest man in America. And he pretended to be, not pretended, but in the English sense, pretended to the earldom of Stirling in Scotland. And he had distant connections that made that real. He pursued that inheritance, which would have given him half of Long Island, most of Maine, and all of Newfoundland, for 10 years, and essentially bankrupted himself. So when he goes into this battle, he's busted. He's living on the imperiousness of his good name. And I think that's one of the motivating forces that I was looking at when I found what I think is the answer to why he decided to attack the British at that moment.
Did you come to an answer to that question of as to why this man decided to go into battle against what he and I'm sure a lot of other Americans still regarded as his king?
It's complicated, and I think there were a lot of reasons, but I think there was real frustration. He'd pursued this inheritance, which by the right of primogeniture should have been his, in England for a number of years, and finally it simply was not accepted. The Parliament chose not to deal with it. And, you know, this land grant had been given in 1604, and by 1773, the land was fully developed, and there was no need for them to have some nobleman claiming all the return on this investment. So I think he was really frustrated, and I think he was a man who had a number of failures in his life, and this opportunity presented himself. He had the men. The Marylanders were young men, age 15 to maybe 25, who had been training. The militiamen were required to train once a year, and apparently these young men were wealthy enough to afford real uniforms, and they had the modern muskets. And they were trained in European fighting techniques, and Stirling found himself with them and with a responsibility, and he accepted it.
He also had a strong idea of what they were fighting for, and the crux of the battle and the crux of your film is a seesaw battle over a stone house. Each side attacked in turn. The 400 Marylanders steadily whittled as the much larger British numbers began to tell. The last charge, the third charge of the Marylanders, and again, let's hear Graham Malcolm, the actor, as General Alexander.
Now, Marylanders, now is the time to take what is ours. Prepare to charge. We will take that house because it is ours. It does not belong to them. We have made this land. We have cut these roads. We have built these houses. Charge, men, and take it from them!
A charge caught them by surprise as they were reloading.
We drove them out of the garden. One group entered the house. And soon the redcoats they found inside were pushed from the upper story windows, and we killed them on the ground. Again, we found the cannon loaded and turned them on the fleeing British. Through the cannon smoke, I could see General Cornwallis watching from a distance. Behind him, rank after rank of fresh soldiers stood.
General Alexander Stirling was captured in the battle. Actually, he surrendered.
Oh, that's true. And then he was marched off and sat on Admiral Howe's ship for 6 weeks, after which he was traded back to the Americans for the governor of Florida and the Bahamas.
It's quite common in those days for the opposing commander to be offered the hospitality of his opponent's table.
Very much so. He knew a number of these people from his pursuit of his earldom, and he would have fit in perfectly comfortably. I mean, the part of the reason we chose Graham was his wonderful Scots-British accent. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I hoped is that people would understand that these were part of the same country. This was, in a certain sense, a civil war. They knew each other. Stirling knew Cornwallis. Stirling had listened to Grant. They were part of the same country, and it was a big deal for them to break off.
Our guest is filmmaker Joseph McCarthy. He's made a short film about the Battle of Brooklyn called The Brave Man. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joseph McCarthy, writer, director, and producer of the short film The Brave Man. What was the significance of this particular battle in your view?
The first significance is Stirling Alexander stopped the British. I like to say that he was like a traffic accident on the Brooklyn Queens Expressway. The British were... The British, you got to understand this, yes, he recognized 15,000 men coming from the backside that was totally undefended, but those men were coming up a road that was the width of a wagon with forests on both sides. So when he hit the front, Cornwallis's advance there, the Grenadiers, I think there were 2,000 men, it stopped the British army. And when an army stops, what does it do? It sits down. Once to get an army started of that size takes a long time. Howe and Clinton, who were the British generals, had hoped to arrive in the early part of the day at the foot of Brooklyn Heights and overwhelm the 12,000 Americans. I guess there were 9,000 because 3,000 were in the field at the time. But because of the action of these men, he was unable to do that. And then Washington was so impressed with what Stirling's men had been able to do, he thought he'd stand and fight the best army in the world. Other minds convinced him over the next day and a half that maybe being stuck with your back to the water with the largest fleet in the world, potentially being able to come up the river behind you with the best army in the world in front of you, wasn't the best place to be. And he pulled off the most miraculous escape, retreat, that I think most, it's comparable to Dunkirk, that people have not heard of anything like this before.
With the great assistance of the men of Marblehead, the fishermen and sailors.
Yes, very much so. And people from up and down the East River who contributed their boats and their own skills, too. The Marbleheaders, apparently, there's a description of one of them who crossed the East River, which is nearly a mile wide, 20 times with boats loaded up to the gunwales. Washington was able to get 9,000 plus men off Brooklyn Heights with their supplies, with their weapons, and their horses over the course of the evening. Howe arrived at the Heights the next morning to find the embers of the watchfires that they'd kept going throughout the night while they stealthily sneaked across the river. I mean, it's just an amazing story.
As you mentioned, the Howe brothers had arrived in New York with a huge fleet and a huge army. Clearly, they hoped that this display of overwhelming power and maybe one short, sharp shock would convince the Americans to give up the rebellion. Despite the best efforts of General Alexander and the Marylanders, they did quickly chase George Washington off the Brooklyn Heights and onto Manhattan and chased him away from there further. Why didn't that one short, sharp shock have the desired effect?
Well, I think Washington survived with 9,000 men and his gear. I think there is some sense that the Americans were heartened by the resistance that Sterling and the Marylanders put up. I think in a certain sense that they were not defeated. They were defeated in the Gowanus Valley, but a strategic retreat is a perfectly legitimate military tactic, and that's what happened. It was he pulled off a strategic retreat, moved to Manhattan. There's a story that that the Americans were marching up Bloomingdale Road, which we now call Broadway, as the British were marching down the Boston Post Road, which is Third Avenue. And there were forest in between them as they, I mean, you have to live in Manhattan to really get this, but it would be, I mean, there are lots of trees, and the two armies couldn't see each other. So the Americans escaped north. I think the first firefight was up about 110th Street. When the Americans resisted the British who were chasing them.
Joseph McCarthy, we see an awful lot of Revolutionary War battlefields memorialized, Saratoga, certainly Yorktown, Bunker Hill. What happened in Brooklyn?
Commerce. If you read Mike Wallace's book, Gotham, which everybody sees as daunting, this 1,400-page history of New York, but it's really not. It's just a great read. You realize that New York was really founded as a commercial enterprise, and it still is. That's the driving force. And this land where the Marylanders and the rest of the men who died in the Gowanus Valley were buried in long open pits was described in the deed for that land as a national treasure, and it said that this land should not be built upon. But Mr. Litchfield, whose house sits up in Prospect Park, bought the land down the hill from him along Park Slope and down to the Gowanus Valley and developed the whole area. You see it now as sort of flat and paved and very urban, but at the time that this battle was fought, it was a rocky, hilly hillsides with ravines, and the farms were along the side of an inlet called the Gowanus Creek.
Far wilder than the rather, the tamed views of Prospect Park.
Well, you can see the original landscape in Greenwood Cemetery. The Greenwood Cemetery and Park Slope and Prospect Park and that whole area are the terminal moraine for the last ice age. And creeks and springs ran down the side of this, and it was really hilly. So they scraped the tops off the hills and filled in the ravines. And that's how you wind up with a beautiful brownstone neighborhood, Park Slope.
Joseph McCarthy's film is The Brave Man. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
A reenactment of the Battle of Brooklyn will be held in Prospect Park later this month. For more information on McCarthy's film, log on to his website, www.thebraveman.com. Coming up, a tribute to Mississippi John Hurt. This is Fresh Air.
answer. How can it be? You can rest everybody, but cruel Stagger Lee, that bad man, oh cruel Stagger Lee.
That's Mississippi John Hurt from a 1928 recording of his song Stagger Lee. Hurt faded into obscurity until he was rediscovered as a blues elder in 1963. He recorded again and performed on the folk revival circuit until his death in 1966. A new tribute album shows that his appeal cuts across styles and generations. Music critic Milo Miles has a review of Avalon Blues.
Well, make me dance, pallet on your floor. On your floor, make me a pallet down soft and low. Make me a pallet on your floor up the country.
On the surface, everything about Mississippi John Hurt suggests he is just a homespun entertainer eager to please. He spent most of his life as a hardscrabble farmer, and this blues musician stuff was just a bonus. But in fact, everything about Hurt's music is sneaky. The way he tells a story, the way he fingerpicks guitar, the way he varies his themes. Sex, religion, good food, and bad breaks all creep in through the back door. No surprise that the album Avalon Blues, a tribute to Mississippi John Hurt, includes covers by performers as diverse as Beck, Ben Harper, John Hyatt, Lucinda Williams, and Steve Earle, who does Hurt's most well-known tune.
Well, all you ladies gather round, good sweet candy man, town candy man. Oh, candy man, you got a stick of candy that's 9 inch long, you sell it as fast as a hog, chew it strong, candy man. Oh, candy man.
So, you know the drill. The big names are meant to hook fans who know nothing about Mississippi John Hurt. But Avalon Blues is more sprightly and varied than many tribute projects. Because Hurt performed almost exclusively solo, hearing his songs with more instruments is always a treat. A masterful player like Chris Smither demonstrates how much fresh juice you can get out of a straightforward rendition of Frankie and Albert.
Frankie was a good girl, everybody knows. She paid $100 for half of a suit of clothes. He's a man. Been doing it wrong. Frankie went to the bar.
Victoria Williams, on the other hand, howls her way through Since I've Laid My Burden Down in her best crazy lady fashion. I think it's a highlight of the album because it will offend the sensitive and tasteful crowd who enjoy John Hurt's decorum entirely too much. Avalon Blues works fine as either an introduction to Hurt or as a supplement to the original music. A generous selection of his 1960s work appears on the album called Rediscovered. But I wouldn't want to be without his early sides from a CD also called Avalon Blues, but subtitled Complete 1928 OK Recordings.
Miss Collins, sweet Miss Collins, home to see her son was leaving home. The angels laid him away. The angels laid him away. They laid him 6 feet under the clay. The angels laid him away.
Dick Waterman was Hurt's manager after his rediscovery, and it seems right to end by quoting this anecdote from Waterman's liner notes in Avalon Blues. Waterman was introducing Hurt at a college concert. I talked about his having been rediscovered in Avalon, Mississippi by Tom Hoskins in 1963. I talked about how he had made a sensational appearance at the Newport Folk Festival shortly after that. As I talked on and on, I kept glancing from side to side, expecting John to appear any time. I finally looked up into the balcony, and there was John sitting in the front row with his face in his hands on the railing, looking down at me. "John," I sighed, "you can't play from up there. You have to come down here." After the show, I asked him why he had sat up there while I was talking so long. "Well now, Dick," he said, "you got to be saying such nice things about me that I didn't want to do nothing to cause you to stop."
Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. He reviewed Avalon Blues, a tribute album to Mississippi John Hurt. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Neil Conan.
Police officer, how can it be? You can arrest everybody but Cool Staggerly, that bad man, Cool Staggerly.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House, publishers of Deborah Tannen's new book, I Only Say This Because I Love You, How the Way We Talk Can Make or Break Family Relationships Throughout Our Lives. And Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The upcoming UN World Conference on Racism will be held in South Africa. On the next Fresh Air, we meet two South African journalists who talk about race and racism in their country. I'm Neil Conan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.